Well, good morning. I'm Pastor Steve. The title of my sermon is one word, Providence. Now, when I say Providence here in New England, everybody thinks of the city in Rhode Island, right? Everybody thinks of, you know, oh yeah, that's where Brown University is, et cetera, et cetera. But the word Providence is actually a theological term as well. In fact, that's really the more accurate meaning. The city of Providence was actually named by a Baptist minister, Roger Williams. And he named the city after this theological concept of Providence. So you could actually use it as a name for God, or you can use it as an attribute of God. And the word providence is from the Latin. Some of you are Latin scholars here. And it means to see in advance. See before. Pro video. Okay? So it talks about how God can see in advance and that He can care and protect and provide for us. Okay? So, it talks about God's sovereignty. It talks about how He can orchestrate events for His purposes. And so, I chose that title because as we look further into the book of Esther, we can see God's providence. That He is working in a way that orchestrates events toward a certain purpose. Now, I think it's been mentioned in this series that God is not even mentioned in this book. And you look through it and you say, well, it's kind of strange that a book in the Bible wouldn't even mention God by name. The king that's mentioned in this story, King Ahasuerus, who's the king of Persia, he's mentioned 175 times in this book. God, not once. And yet, we see God's fingerprints, you might say, all over this story. And King Ahasuerus, the most powerful king, Persian king, he's really nothing compared to God. Now, some of you may know King Ahasuerus from his Greek name, which is Xerxes. And some of you who are ancient history buffs, you know about the Battle of Thermopylae. Or some of you seen the movie or something, 300 Spartans and that kind of thing. This is the same king, Xerxes, or King Ahasuerus. And so Pastor Tom gave us a very good historical overview last week. And I don't have his slides and everything, but hopefully you remember that. But there's some of you who might be somewhat new, who just come here listening to this series for the first time. So I need to give you sort of a recap. So my plan is to share with you the story and then give you some lessons. Spiritual lessons that we can learn from this story. So, again, King Ahasuerus is the king over this vast Persian empire. And in terms of Jewish history, this is during the time that the Jewish people were taken to captivity to Babylon. And they were there 70 years. And after that, some of them returned back to the Promised Land, and that's recorded in Nehemiah and Ezra. In fact, it was under the Persian king Cyrus, who is the grandfather of Ahasuerus. And so, chapter 1 talks about how the king was having a war council, and they ended it with this wild banquet, orgy, whatever you want to call it. And he wanted his queen, Queen Vashti, to kind of make an appearance because he wanted to kind of show her off. She didn't want to be shown off to all these drunken people. And so she refuses, and as a result, she was demoted, you might say, as queen, and they had to find a new queen. Chapter 2 tells us how the king wanted to get this new queen. They, in some sense, had this Miss Persia contest, you know, and they kind of looked throughout the whole empire for all the most beautiful women and perhaps drafted them and said, okay, you're in the contest. And so it was up to the king to choose from all these beautiful women who would be the queen. And this girl, a Jewish girl named Esther, was chosen. Now, Esther, as I mentioned, is a Jewish girl. She was orphaned as a child. She was raised by her cousin Mordecai. And probably maybe about 15 years older than Esther. And Esther is not of any kind of royal blood. In fact, again, she is a Jew. But as she was elevated to the position of queen, her cousin Mordecai told her, don't tell anybody you're a Jew. Because a lot of people didn't like Jews. They didn't like them then, and even today. There's a lot of anti-Semitism today. And Mordecai apparently worked sort of for the government. It mentions that he worked at the king's gate. And so apparently he has some position in the government. And in Esther chapter 2, he overhears an assassination plot to kill the king, Ahasuerus. And so he reports it, and all the people that were involved were executed. But there was no reward or recognition for Mordecai for what he did. In chapter 3, introduces a new person named Haman. Now Haman's the bad guy, you might say, in this whole story. But he rises to power to, you might say, be like prime minister, number two person after the king. And the king even comes to trust in him so that pretty much Haman could do what he would want. And however, even though Haman had risen to this high position, Mordecai, Esther's cousin, did not give him the honor that he thought he deserved. And so he kind of got mad at Mordecai, realized that he was a Jew, and kind of like said, I don't like Jews, okay? And so he had a plot to kill Mordecai as well as all the Jews. And so this was his idea of genocide or ethnic cleansing, whatever you want to call it. It's not a new concept. And so Haman waits for the right time, deceives the king, gets him to sign a law that says that gave permission for people to kill the Jews and to take their property. Now, he also consulted an astrologer. And that was very common in those days, because they want to know, when's the best time for this law to take effect? And so, you know, they cast lots and do all these different things. And they basically decided upon a date that would be about a year later. So all this ethnic cleansing, genocide, would not take place until about a year later. But the Jews certainly hear about this, and they are in mourning. And this is chapter 4 now of Esther. Mordecai becomes aware of it. He and the other Jews were mourning publicly about this. And so Mordecai realizes that Esther at least had some way of appealing to the king, since she was the queen. Now, you know, there was sort of like this funny relationship between the king and queen. It wasn't like they kind of lived as husband and wife. They saw each other. You know, I think they probably, the queen would see the king occasionally, you know, because he had all these harem and he had all these women. So he didn't really need the queen too much except whenever he needed her. And so And so she could not necessarily just go to the king and ask for his help. She had to, in some sense, be invited by the king to appear before him. And if you were not invited by the king, potentially you could be killed. All right? Unless the king extended his scepter and says, okay, you can come and see me, you would be executed and killed. And so Mordecai wants Esther to go to the king and plead for the life of all the Jews. And Esther is scared. She's afraid. And but yet Mordecai says, we don't have any other choice. And so we pick up the reading that was just read, and we look at Esther chapter 4 and verse 13. It says, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. If you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And so Esther in verse 15 replies, go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, the capital. Hold a fast on my behalf. Do not eat or drink 3 days or night. And I and my young women will also fast as you do. And then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. And so I read that again because this passage is the critical part of this whole book. One of the things that we're teaching in Sunday school in Chinatown is how to study the Bible. And one of the method is this observation, interpretation, application kind of process. And so in the beginning, observation is looking at what is there. And so if you were to read this entire book of Esther, you would say, this is the key passage right here in chapter 4 that was read. That everything kind of changes and hinges on this one event. That before that, everything's kind of building up to this point. And then after that, we see how things unfold. And so, I know that Pastor Tom kind of talked a little bit about this passage last week, and I've been assigned to talk about chapters 5 through 7. But I wanted to first look back at exactly the setting for this whole thing. And then chapters 5 through 7, we'll see how the story unfolds. And you might say, all this happens in a very short period of time. That perhaps it could even happen as short as 24 hours. Now, I like that TV show, 24, right? I don't know if you watched that, but it's kind of exciting. I mean, I don't agree with everything that he does and all that kind of thing, but, you know, it's kind of exciting to watch this, you know, how, you know, the world's going to be put into chaos. It's going to be the World War III will start. All these different things are going to happen. And then, you know, we see that the hero works through all these problems, challenges, whatever you want to call it, and then saves the world, right? And it all happens in 24 hours, right? Very, very quickly, things change from the brink of disaster to, you know, joy and victory and that kind of thing. Well, this is what's going to happen in these chapters, from Esther chapter 5 to chapter 7. They all happen, you know, maybe not in 24 hours, but in a very short period of time. You know, things go from disaster to joy and victory at this home. And you know, how it plays out is sort of a cliffhanger as well. And so, let me give you again the story that will happen in chapters 5, 6, and 7, and then we're going to look at some spiritual lessons that God has for us from these chapters. So, in chapter 5, it talks about how Esther waited those 3 days. He had instructed Mordecai to have the Jews fast. And meanwhile, she was preparing, and she was going to go and intercede before the king. And so she comes before the king, and we read that the king was actually quite favorable to her. He extends his scepter to her so that she wasn't going to kill her. And in fact, he promises, maybe he was just overcome with her beauty, that he says, "Oh, I'm going to give you anything you want, blank check," right? And so Esther doesn't say, "Oh yeah, I want you to save the Jews." She says, why don't we have a feast? Why don't we invite Haman, the number two guy, the bad guy, and we're going to have a feast together. And so they have the banquet, they're all there. And then she says, and then the king again asks, what do you want? And it's just like 24, you know, you got to watch it again, and it's all this, we're getting like antsy and excited, and then we're kind of like, oh, wait until next week. Okay, so basically she says, well, come to another banquet, okay, tomorrow. Come to another banquet, then I'll tell you exactly what I want, okay? And Haman, the bad guy in this thing, he goes home, and he's really proud of himself. I mean, he's kind of like, oh, wow, I mean, not only good graces with the king, I mean, good graces with the queen. You know, life is good. But then he sees Mordecai, and Mordecai doesn't kind of bow to him and things, and he gets upset, and he says, you know, I'm going to get this Mordecai, I'm going to kill him even earlier, you know, than we're going to kill all the Jews, you know, and he has these gallows prepared to kill Mordecai sooner. And he was going to ask the king to execute Mordecai. And this gallows is not like the, you know, sometimes you see these westerns and they have these hangings and things like that. It's not like that. They actually was like a really long pole, maybe even 7 stories high, and they would impale the person on top of this thing. You know, that's how they killed people in those days. And so Mordecai tells his workers to prepare these gallows because he wants to kill Mordecai in this way. Esther chapter 6. The king is in bed, but he can't sleep. All right? Now, when we can't sleep, what do? Right? We take a sleeping pill, or we, count sheep. But the king's method of going to sleep, it says, start reading to me the court records, all the things that happened during my reign. And so they begin to read him the chronicles of, you know, all the king's affairs for the last so many years. And they go back even to 12 years ago, and they read to him the story about how Mordecai prevented this assassination plot. And he asks, well, okay, this guy saved my life. How did we reward this guy? And they said, we didn't do anything for him. And he said, really? We didn't do anything for him. We need to reward this person. All right? And so the next day, the king begins to hold court, and he sees Haman, again the bad guy, coming in. Haman is ready to ask the king to kill Mordecai. But before he can say anything, the king says, I want to honor somebody who's really helped me, and I want to show my real appreciation for this person. What should I do? And so Haman thinks that, oh, maybe it's me he wants to honor. And so thinks of all this stuff, horses, special clothing, everything. You know, and he says, yeah, we should do all this stuff for this person. And then the king says, do this for Mordecai. You know? And so it's hilarious. I mean, if you really are reading the biblical record here. And so it forces Haman, the bad guy, to honor and elevate Mordecai, the person that he really hates, okay, in this whole situation. Chapter 7 of Esther is the climax, where they finally have this second banquet, and Esther comes out with it and asks the king, say, okay, you know, this is my request. I want you to know that I'm a Jew, because previously she didn't reveal to the fact that she was a Jew, and all my people are going to be killed, and we're going to be annihilated, we're going to be destroyed. And, you know, the king gets really furious about that. And who caused this? And they said it was Haman. He was the one. And so the king has Haman executed. In fact, he is impaled on those gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. And so, you know, within a very short period of time, maybe 24 hours, they went from disaster to this sense of relief that's here. All right? And so, what are some of the spiritual lessons that we can learn from this story? And I'd like to share three. And I also want to share with you a New Testament reference as well. Because, you know, sometimes as you read the story, you may not sort of get it. But in the New Testament, there's a lot of things that were written that were much more explicit that might be able to help us to have further insight into that. And so, the first lesson that we can learn from Esther chapter 5 through 7 is prayer makes a difference. Prayer makes a difference. Now, the New Testament in James chapter 5 verse 16 says, "The prayer of a righteous person has great power as it is working." All right? So, James affirms the fact that prayer makes a difference. And how do we see this story in the book of Esther? Well, as we had read in the end of chapter 4, Esther, when she realized that she is going to be put in this very difficult, critical situation to go and intercede before the king. And so she could either lose her life or she could be granted her request. And so she instructs her people to fast. All right? Now, again, it doesn't say pray, right? It says to fast. But usually when you talk about fasting in a spiritual sense, you talk about prayer as well. And maybe the writer of Esther is trying to avoid using those terms, because certainly by design, they're not mentioning God. And yet we know God is working in there. And so maybe their way of fasting, they're saying fasting, is sort of like their way of saying prayer in this whole thing. And so she has all the people to fast for 3 days. And then we see the result of what happened. Now certainly, if you look at Esther chapter 5, verse 1, it says, "On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes." So, obviously, she was doing some preparation. She got on her royal robes, okay? That would be very distinctive. That would be, obviously, it was the queen. I would imagine that Esther also, you might say, dolled herself up as well, right? Because she was already a very beautiful woman, and the king was already overcome with her beauty, that she did all this preparation. She put on the nice clothes, put on the nice makeup, all these kinds of things. And what happens? In verse 2 it says, "She won favor in his sight." All right? Now, was it the clothes? Was it the makeup? Or was it God? Right? And, you know, so you could have a human explanation for it. Or you could say, didn't they fast for 3 days? Didn't they, you know? And so we would say, okay, yeah, you know, God was working. Their prayers were effective. In fact, he was so favorable to the queen. He said, "What is your request? It shall be given you even to the half of my kingdom." Now, I don't think necessarily literally that he was going to give her half the kingdom. That might have been some colloquial expression to basically say, you know, you have a blank check, I can give you just about anything. All right? But he was very favorable to her. And again, how did that happen? You know, because, you know, Ahasuerus, Xerxes was a very known for to be a very temperamental kind of person. And so, again, prayer was working in this situation. Prayer makes a difference. The second lesson that we can see from these chapters is that there are consequences for our actions. There are consequences for our actions. Galatians chapter 6, verse 7 gives us the New Testament counterpart. It says, Paul writes, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever one sows, that he will also reap." All right? So this idea of sowing and reaping, which is sort of a farming kind of idea, that if you sow certain kinds of seeds, you're going to get a certain kind of crop. And so the idea is that what you do, whether it's good or bad, will have consequences. All right? Good or bad for you. And so in a negative way, we could see this in Haman. Because Haman is this evil person that's there. And if you kind of read through the book of Esther, you really see how egotistical he is, how hateful he is of the Jews. And he's really hilarious. And some people compare him to like Hitler, the Antichrist, you know, all these different people, right? He's a bad guy. And yet, you know, he was elevated to power to be the number two person in the kingdom, prime minister. But later on, he's executed. He's killed. He's impaled on the gallows. He was preparing for someone else. How did that happen? God was working because God instituted judgment upon him. His actions had consequences, you see. So sometimes we think we live in a world that, oh, you know, what happens, happens. But no, God is working things out that ultimately there will be justice, and those who do bad will suffer negative consequences. On the other hand, you could also see this in a positive way, that actions have consequences. Mordecai, okay, remember earlier, 12 years ago, Mordecai had prevented an assassination attempt on the king. And he turned these people in, and the king was saved, but somehow they didn't reward Mordecai. He went back to his old job, did the same old thing, and no one seemed to realize it, no one seemed to appreciate it, and nothing happened for 12 years. Until later on, the king, as he was sleepless, right, was being read these accounts and said, oh, this person wasn't rewarded. And so that aspect had an important part to play in helping the king to decide to execute Haman. Because he saw that Mordecai was a Jew, but he was a good person, and it helped him. And so sometimes we can do things and no one notices what we do, right? No one recognizes it. You may work hard at a certain ministry, nobody says thanks, nobody says anything. God knows. He sees. And he says that there will be consequences to our actions. Sometimes negative in terms of judgment, also positive in terms of rewards. Maybe we won't get it necessarily in this life, but we can also send the rewards on ahead, right? To heaven. And so our consequences have actions. Thirdly, third spiritual lesson is that even when God is invisible, He is invincible. Okay? And I got this phrase from Chuck Swindoll. I was talking to the staff, pastoral staff, and I was talking about plagiarism, you know, and, you know, we need to be careful. But so I want to attribute that line. I sort of changed it a little bit, but Chuck Swindoll, the pastor, wrote this, and he said, and so the idea is, even when God is invisible, we can't see Him, He is invincible. All right, you can't stop Him for what He's going to do. And so Romans 8:28, You know, Pastor Tommy even alluded to this earlier. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to His purpose. So that verse tells us that God can orchestrate all these events to take place for our good and for His glory. And God may be working invisibly. We may not see Him. He is not even mentioned in this book. And yet, we know God is working. You notice that in this book, also, there are no miracles. Right? I mean, certainly in the Old Testament, you could talk about parting the Red Sea, all these different miracles that take place. And we would say, yeah, God's powerful. He's in control. He can do all things. You know? Right? That's our conclusion when we see a miracle. But there's no miracles here. But we can see God is working. He's working invisibly, but He is working also. He is invincible in that His purposes will be fulfilled. We see this in the book of Esther when Esther was chosen to be queen. You figure, like, in this vast Persian Empire, right? And it goes from Libya to Pakistan, you know, somewhere around that.
Yeah.
And there's like hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of beautiful women, right? I mean, that could be there. And how is it that Esther, of non-royal blood, would be chosen to be queen? And yet, when Mordecai, in the last part of chapter 4, appeals to Esther to go before the king, says, it says, for if you keep silent at this time, this is chapter 4, verse 14, for if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. That is, if Esther doesn't go before the king, God's going to find another way to get His purposes accomplished. Right? That's what He's saying. And, you know, He didn't mention God by name, but how other way is it going to happen? How else are the Jews going to be saved? Only God could do it. And so Mordecai has enough faith to say, you know, if you don't go before the king, if you are silent, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. All right? And the Jews, you know, remember how God had promised to Abraham, I'm going to bless your descendants. I'm going to bless the whole world, in fact, through your descendants, right? Now they were going to be killed, apparently. But God would save His people. And God obviously did save the Jews in this situation. And He used Esther. And it says, Mordecai says, and who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this, that God put you in this position to be the queen so that you can be the person that will save the Jews. That God orchestrated things so that you could be put in that position to make an impact, right? And so you think about how God has put you in your neighborhood, in your house, in your family, in your workplace, and say, God put you there for a purpose. That God has something maybe for you to do strategically so that God's purposes will be accomplished in that situation. And so we see that also in this lesson, even when God is invisible, He is invincible. How were the Jews actually saved in this situation? Well, the king couldn't sleep. He says, oh, can you read these court records to me, you know, so I can go to sleep? They got years and years of court records, but they hit upon the one that talks about Mordecai preventing an assassination plot. Now, if Mordecai was rewarded back 12 years ago, they would just kind of read over it and that'd be it. But no, You know, even back 12 years ago, he wasn't rewarded. And so all these things happened so that God could save the Jews. Now, at this point, the Jews are not completely saved, by the way. Once they put a law that says, we will allow you to kill the Jews, once they make a law like that, that cannot be rescinded. All right? So the Jews are still in jeopardy. But like 24, you've got to come back next week, all right, to find out what happens, right, the next week. All right? Or you can read the Bible and see what happens, right? But right now, you don't know what's going to happen. They're still in danger. There's sort of a partial victory. You know, Haman is the bad guy, is put away. But this law is still there that says, everyone can kill the Jews, and it's okay. So, while God is working, we also realize that He allows for sin and even pain. All right? Remember that Romans 8:28, it says God works all things, not just the good things, but even the bad things that happen to us for our good. So you might say, well, God allowed Haman to rise to be number two in the kingdom, right? I mean, you know, if he didn't rise up to be so powerful, maybe all this stuff would not have happened. But God allowed him to rise to power, and when he got the king to sign this law that says you can kill all the Jews, in chapter 4, verse 3, it says, in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. So apparently, this threat to their lives caused many people to turn to God in this situation. So God used the bad thing that Haman did for something that's good. That caused people, the Jewish people who were scattered all over this empire, maybe some of them weren't looking to God. You know, God was sort of in the back seat of their lives and the back burner of their lives. But when this happened, everyone took notice and began to pray and mourn before the Lord. And so, the practical import of all this is that we can read the newspaper. We can get worried about what's going to happen. But God's in control, right? He can work all things for His good. And yes, there are sin. There is problems. There is pain. But ultimately, God has the victory. And so, you know, one of the things about watching the TV show 24 is I could tell you the hero, Jack Bauer, he's going to survive, all right? I mean, you know, all these things are going to happen to him. It looks like he's going to be killed and all these things are going to happen. I will tell you, he's going to survive because they have to put it on again next year, right? And so we have to know that somehow he's going to survive. And so it's not like we're worried, oh, yeah, oh, boy, he's going to kill this guy. No, he's going to survive. And so in some sense, we kind of know the end of the story also with God. Yeah, there's a lot of problems, there's a lot of dangers, but God ultimately is in control. And so when you hear the word providence, right, I hope you begin to think not of the city, but I think of God. That this is a really great attribute that God has, that He is in control, He is working things, and He sees in advance, and He is working things for our good and for His glory. Let's bow together in prayer. Dear Lord, we give thanks for this story. And even though your name is not even mentioned in this book, we can see how you are working in this situation. And so we ask that you would help us, Lord, that even there are times that you seem to be invisible in our lives. We don't know where you are. And yet, you are working in a very mighty way. And so, Lord, give us the faith that we need and the confidence that we need to live our lives in a way that is pleasing to you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.